sound recording is prepared by the Audiovisual Center of Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, Missouri. No copy of this tape is to be made without the written permission of the Audiovisual Center. The Reverend K.E. Marquardt, member of the Commission on Theology and Interchurch Relations of the Lutheran Church of Australia. On October 11, 1967, at 7 p.m., addresses the faculty and students of Concordia Seminary, St. Louis, Missouri, on the significance of the Lutheran Reformation today. The lecture is already in progress.
Now, in this connection, at once the issue of the Reformation arrives. Particularly in Anglican circles, the Reformation is a very embarrassing and awkward sort of affair today. People would like to forget about it. They believe that it was unecumenical, un-Catholic. It split the church and brought to our modern age the tragedy of division, which is an offense both to Christians and to non-Christians. This, of course, is based to a certain extent upon an illusion, isn't it? Because of Dr. Sasser has pointed out, and also Professor Ehrlich and others, the visible church, the empirical church, has always been divided. Not to this extent, to be sure. But the divisions didn't only originate in the 16th century. Professor Sasser writes in his book, I think it's in This Is My Body, and elsewhere too, that already the Christians in the days of St. Paul in Rome would face the problem which of several conflicting groups would be the genuine Christian church. So in principle, fundamentally, the problem is not new. The Reformation didn't originate, although of course it accentuated, particularly in the Western Church. One thing which causes people particularly to feel convinced that the Reformation was not ecumenical, that it was sectarian, is that it seems to them obvious that the Reformation represented an extreme. And it seems very convincing to Scholar Chesterton, who is a very convincing writer, in saying that the various groups, particularly those that originated at the Reformation, took a partial truth, some aspect of the truth, and then confused this piece of truth with the whole truth, thus distorting it. And then he writes this very clever sentence, that whereas other churches and other various cults and so on, sects, are movements, his church, to which he was converted at Rome, is the balance. Not a movement, it's a balance. It's the thing which takes into consideration all the various aspects of truth and welds them into one harmonious, balanced whole. And this, then, is ecumenical. This many people today find attractive. They don't analyze the package too carefully. But it sounds like a very attractive description. And on the face of it, it seems very convincing that the Reformation represented, shall we say, an extremist point of view. Why? Sola gratia, sola fide, sola scriptura, these solas, alone. That on the face of it is very extremist language, isn't it? It is meant to exclude. And therefore many believe, yes, in order to become truly ecumenical, we must not lose sight of the other side, the other end of the pendulum. And people of all kinds of persuasions are beginning today, they have begun some time ago, are beginning to round off the jagged corners of the solas and see if we can't wear off these offensive solas a bit. The gratia and the fide and the scriptura wouldn't be so bad, but the sola is the extreme element which many can't stomach today and think is unecumenical. But I believe that it is best understood in this sense when we realize that what seems on the face of it to be simply an extreme exaggeration which needs balancing with the corresponding truth. Actually, the three solas really boil down to this one, solus Christus. Finally, all of these, by grace alone, faith alone, scripture alone, finally what it means is Christ alone. And if this is the real meaning, who is to say that this is extreme? Christ is the ecumenical center of the church. And any departure is in the area of Belial, three solas, far from being something on the periphery of the church, far from being something distorted, unbalanced, these three solas are in fact an expression of the ecumenical heart and core and center and center of gravity of the one ecumenical gospel of God, because it really represents the one Christ. So, those who represented these solas, ultimately amounting to the solus Christus, they, and not your position, represent the one ecumenical church. The ecumenical church was not represented at Trent, but at Oxford. I remember I used to be very impressed in thinking of the concept of the Council of Trent. Even when I studied it at the seminary, the ponderous decrees of the Council of Trent, you had the mental picture of some tremendous worldwide gathering there, defining in the consciousness of sitting there representing the universal church. But then when I studied Paul Sarfield's history of the Council of Trent, this grandiose romantic picture collapsed completely, because it becomes then quite evident that the Council of Trent was a very, very sectarian gathering indeed. Sometimes I believe as few as 45 people present, mainly Italians, some Spaniards, some French, but the Germans largely absent. Later, different people being added to it. It was a rather unrepresentative gathering, and their compromising and political phraseology, a classical example of it was this. This is typical of how the Council of Trent dealt with things. There was a terrific dispute with those who had arrived later in the second session of the Council. They wanted to say, the first session is, we must ignore that because we must start afresh. But the Papal Party, who were terribly afraid of losing the papal prestige and safeguards that had been gained at the first session, insisted that this was merely a continuation of the earlier session, and that it was therefore the same council, and that the decree would not be subject to revision. And so, if I'm not mistaken, the papal decree solved the problem by saying, reconvoking continue and continuing convoke, so that both sides could be happy to some extent. And this is how many doctrinal problems were met at Trent also. But the total effect of Trent, of course, was to harden Rome in a sectarian, an anti-ecumenical position, because it was directed against the solus Christus as represented in the sola gratia, sola fide, and sola scriptura. Today, after 400 years, we witness a remarkable sight that these solas are somehow beginning to haunt the Roman Church. At least the Reformation is to some extent beginning to haunt the Roman Church, and to an extent which one wouldn't have thought possible even 10 or 20 years ago. I think that probably, I don't need to tell you much about this, you're probably all aware of the tremendous turmoil going on inside the Roman Church. I wanted to bring with me a little fascinating little book entitled Speeches of Vatican II, Council Speeches of Vatican II. It's a little paperback edited by Father King and some others. And some of these speeches of the bishops are, well, really fantastic. Some of the admissions made cause one to think, well, these people have a dignity and an honesty which in many cases many Protestant churchmen lack. When I read some of the speeches, the self-critical speeches of Vatican Council bishops, I think, if only we Protestants have that kind of honesty and that kind of self-criticism, because with all our Protestantism, you know, we tend to be a very self-congratulatory lot. And it's very hard for us to criticize our own things that happen in our own midst. But there, in the Vatican Council, I remember particularly two speeches. One by the coadjutor bishop of Strasbourg, who said, in so many words, that the divisions, at the beginning of our divisions, as he called them, those who acted did not act primarily and unconditionally against unity, but they began by seeing that certain truths were fundamental in divine revelation. As in the 11th century, it was the truths of the apostolic rights of the churches, in other words, against the papacy, and in the 16th century, the dogma of justification by faith in our Lord Jesus Christ, which had been defined at the first says that it must be admitted that even pastors of our Catholic Church acted, violated charity against those who represented these truths, even though there are certain truths of divine revelation. There are other quotations like that, which really calls one to take off one's hat to the honesty and integrity of those who are capable of saying such things. And if you read, for example, Father Coombs, it's amazing, in a book that he has written in response to Karl Barth on the doctrine of justification, he, as a New Testament scholar, comes practically to the same conclusions as Luther at some basic, at some critical points. For example, that justification is imputation, that salvation is by grace, not by works. Now, Rome traditionally used to say that when St. Paul excludes works, he is excluding the works of the ceremonial law. No such thing. He means all works, including those of the moral law. Again, traditionally, Rome used to say salvation by grace. That means this infused grace, this mysterious spiritual electricity that God infuses, which then produces good works, which then saves. No such thing. The grace of God that saves is the favor of God, not this infused thing. So, at some very decisive critical points, he comes on the basis of the New Testament, the letters of St. Paul, to the same conclusions as did Martin Luther. Father King is so bad that his books, I understand, have been forbidden to be sold in Rome. Now, on the basis of this, there are people who wax very optimistic, and I believe, I think I've seen it in print, even in Lutheran circles, words to this effect that, well, the Reformation has at last won out. At least at the Vatican Council there was a breakthrough. It has accomplished its purpose, and now we can all join and accept the Holy Father as at least a kind of figurehead, and the Reformation has achieved its purpose. Of course, one swallow doesn't make a spring as yet. And I think it would be a misjudgment to think that the kind of theology that I was here sketching, that this was the dominating influence of the Vatican Council. I fear rather that this is only one aspect of a general openness which is tending not toward Luther and the scriptures, but toward the so-called ecumenical theology, with the object of maneuvering into a position of leadership inside the World Council of Churches, who, by the way, I believe can have the way. So, I believe the opening in Rome is primarily toward this, what we would call contemporary theology, rather than to traditional Lutheran or biblical theology. On the other hand, Zwingli, to go back to the time of the Reformation, dealt with Rome. Zwingli didn't represent the ecumenical movement either. When Zwingli denied the real presence, then he was denying to that extent the one Lord and his one faith into which all Christians are baptized. When Luther, they refused in the end, refused in the hand of fellowship, this was an act of ecumenicity, because it was an act of loyalty to the one Lord. It wasn't the stubbornness of one man that divided the church. When Luther wrote there on the table at Marburg, in chalk, before the discussions began, "Hoc est corpus meum, this is my body," and then referred to it, and resisted every temptation to move away from that, he there was representing ecumenical truth, not sectarian narrowness. He was there representing the one Lord and his one faith. So the end, yes, I'd like to quote this here. Dr. Pieper, in one of his lectures to the seminary student body here, said, "Please don't habituate yourselves to talk about the reformers. Strictly speaking, there is one reformer, Martin Luther. Because to the extent that Zwingli and Calvin deviated from him, of course, they did not represent the one ecumenical truth of God." The net result of this brief thumbnail sketch is simply this, that the Augsburg Confession, as it was presented there in 1530, is not the narrow, unbalanced expression of a faction, of a sect, something that must be overcome, something that must receive more balance. But this is the voice of the one Holy Catholic Church, and our forefathers were conscious of confessing in that faith. They were conscious of representing there the Catholic faith, the universal faith, not Gospel Confession teach us about the way of unity in the church. And this great confession teaches us some very profound things about the unity of the church. This great confession teaches us the great satis est. It is enough for the true unity of the church. It is enough to agree concerning the pure teaching of the gospel and the right administration of the sacraments. It presupposes that the church is one, and that those who purely confess the gospel represent that one church. The church as an article of faith, not the church in the sense of Archbishop William Temple, one of the co-founders of the ecumenical movement, who said, "I believe one holy Catholic Church, and I regret that it does not yet exist." No, the confessors of Augsburg knew that this church existed, though God saw it. It was not a reality of faith, of sight, but of faith. And it could be found in the pure marks of the church, as the Apology points out, the pure word, the pure gospel, and the sacraments. Now, that means that the Augsburg Confession at one stroke does away with false props of the unity of the church. It sweeps them aside as irrelevant, not only irrelevant, but harmful. From earliest days, Christians faced the problem of how to guarantee the unity of the church. And one of the earliest answers was that the unity of the church is guaranteed by the bishop. Cling to the bishop, was the advice, and then you will have unity. That was very good until some bishops became heretics and fell away from the church. Then this was proved to be a false crutch and a false standard of unity. Finally, in the West, it developed to this, that the papacy is the guarantor of unity. But even many Roman Catholics today are beginning to see that what they used to think was a rock of the papacy, immovable, solid, dependable, was in fact papier-mâché, and is shaking in all directions at the present time, and its future is by no means certain. Others believe that the apostolic succession is the guarantee of the unity of the Church. Others believe that organization, a certain form of church organization, will guarantee it. If everybody is very obedient to decisions of synods and bylaws and that sort of thing, then we will have some sort of unity. Still others believe that liturgy can do the trick, if only we are one in liturgy. This is a particularly un-Lutheran thing. Let me give an example. Supposing that Russia were liberated. That could happen one day, with the unrest, for instance, at Moscow University today. One of these that Russia could be free, and our missionaries could go in and officially do mission work in the Soviet Union, in the former Soviet Union. What then? Would we then begin to import our so-called Lutheran liturgy and translate it faithfully into Russian and try to accommodate modified Gregorian chant to the Russians? That would be most un-Lutheran, wouldn't it? What we ought to do in that case would be to do as Luther did. Do for the Russian Eastern liturgy what Luther did for the Western liturgy. Don't throw up with these tremendous treasures of the Eastern liturgy. If you've ever heard an Eastern Orthodox Easter service, well, it's quite an unforgettable experience. All right, purify. Use a knife and throw out the superstitions, the worship of Mary, the worship of the saints, the idea of sacrifice. Get rid of this. But keep the framework. Keep what can be kept. And this would be the Lutheran principle in that case, not importing some Western Lutheran liturgy. Because the one thing that unites the church is the pure gospel and the sacraments. The forms are secondary, and there we must adapt ourselves to the local conditions in such a way as not to put any obstacles in the path of the gospel. This would be Lutheran. I've mentioned these things in detail because I wish to distinguish this sort of thing very carefully from another interpretation of the satis est, which have become quite popular today. When our confessor said it is enough to agree concerning the gospel and the sacraments, they meant an agreement in reality, not merely in form or in word. They meant something real, not something imaginary or purely formal or something like this. I'd like to read one sentence which indicates a view of Augustana 7 which is very wrong and very widespread. This comes from page 18 of the official report, the nature of the Lutheran World Federation presented at Helsinki by the, I think, the Department of the Commission on Theology. On page 18 we read that, according to Augustana 7, agreement in the understanding and the proclamation of the gospel and administration of the sacraments in accord with their institution is absolutely requisite, but also sufficient, Sati says. Formally, this condition is presupposed by the member churches whose confessional positions correspond to the doctrinal basis of the LWF. Therefore, these churches are spiritually obligated above and beyond their having come together in the LWF to enter into mutual church fellowship and to declare the consummation of church fellowship through their official orders. Because by their subscription to the constitution of the LWF, their subscription to the Oath of Confession, that makes them one doctrine. So they should be in fellowship. Now this presupposes, of course, that you become, that agreement in the gospel and the sacraments means no more than putting in your constitution some reference to the Oath of Confession. But the important thing is not the formality of the reference, but the reality. What is really actually happening with regard to this confession? What is done with it? In what sense is it related to practical church life? In entering this particular section, I'd like to begin by quoting Reinhold Niebuhr, who in a biographical sketch or a biography of the American President Woodrow Wilson said, and this is a classic sentence, "As a typical son of the manse, he believed too much in words." Now think of that. As a typical son of the manse, he believed too much in words. I think there's tremendous wisdom in these words. And I think that we must be very careful to distinguish words from reality. And especially when it comes to these important confessional matters. At once, we're confronted with a fact, for instance, that confession isn't a matter of a name. Here, perhaps we could stop for a brief footnote on the very name Lutheran. That doesn't sound very ecumenical, does it? And frankly, I don't mind admitting that I'm not particularly happy that we have accepted this particular designation. I think the Calvinists got a rather better deal out of it with the lovely name of Reform. We should have grabbed that and held on to it. But the name Lutheran, after a man, sounds a bit, it sounds very peculiar to somebody who knows nothing about it. It may be all right in Europe, in Germany, where Luther is a national hero and everybody has heard of him, but in the English-speaking world, the name Lutheran seems to me to be rather a missionary liability. At first, the Lutheran Church didn't dream of accepting that title. Our confessions never speak of the Lutheran Church. Our confessions only speak of our Reformed churches or our evangelical churches in schools. There's one reference, I believe there's one reference, to this effect, the Dear Gospel of Christ, which the opponents call Lutheran. But that's all. There's never any reference to a Lutheran church. If the official court history of the ecumenical movement is Grouse and Stephen Neal, I think, the history of the ecumenical movement from 1517 to 1948. This book regards the creation of the World Council of Churches as a culmination of Christian church history, more or less. And in that book, there is this interesting tidbit that it seems Nicholas Hunnius was the first one who accepted and used the word Catholic in the sense of Roman Catholic, which today is practically universal. People tell us they say Catholic when they mean Roman and papal, which is anything but Catholic. They think Nicholas Hunnius used that word for the first time in the sense of Roman Catholic. And then Veit Ludwig von Seckendorf and his history accepted the Jesuit Meinberg's terms, where he wrote the history of Lutheranism and of Calvinism. And he, in refuting that book, accepted the term Lutheranism and Calvinism, and that's how the thing was stuck. Well, on the other hand, although Luther said that Christians should not be called after my name, who am I, miserable bag of worms, that they should be called after me? We're Christians. We didn't invent the doctrine, it's Christ's doctrine. But on the other hand, if Luther confessed truly, then of course we can't be ashamed of his name either. And there we see a parallel between the ancient church and the Lutheran, in that the followers of the Council of Nicaea were called Athanasians. And the opponents of Pelagius were called Augustinians, even though they represented the one Catholic faith and the name didn't stick at least to it. But finally, it's not much use arguing about a term, and perhaps we can take to heart Chesterton's advice, who said, "I'm so interested in what you mean, but I don't bother very much about what you really say." So long as we understand what is meant by Lutheran, that we take it in the right ecumenical sense, then we need not take offense or give offense with the mere term. However, when it comes to the matter of what constitutes agreement in the gospel, there it is very important not merely to take words or names or realities. It has become the fashion simply to take formal subscription to these things as evidence of agreement in doctrine. For instance, strangely enough, in another pamphlet from the same source, also on page 18, we read this interesting statement: "The statements about the pre-existence and the Trinity are nothing more than interpretations of the basic soteriological statement, God was in Christ for our salvation." Now, in the light of the discussion within the LWF, I can only take that to mean that those people who, like Sittler, Joseph Sittler, suggest that perhaps the doctrine of Christ's pre-existence is merely a bit of philosophical speculation, some antiquated Aristotelian or Platonic metaphysics or what have you, it's not essential to the gospel. That people like this are merely supplying a modern interpretation, equally valid, of the basic soteriological statement, God was in Christ for our salvation. And the meaning here is that you can take it or leave it. This is only metaphysics. And however you interpret it, so long as you agree on this basic gospel that God is in Christ. But I would suggest that this basic gospel isn't, of course, just a verbal formality. It presupposes a whole substance which is indivisible. Luther said, the gospel, the articles of faith are like a chain, with links, or like a circle. You break it at one point and you've broken the whole circle. They all belong together. If you have over here, Christ, as second person of the Blessed Trinity, as eternally pre-existing God, incarnate Son of God. Over here, Christ as only the man for others, and not pre-existent eternal God, second person of the Blessed Trinity. Then you cannot say, well, we're all agreed in this that God was in Christ. Because the foundation on this side is lacking. There is no gospel based on one who is merely a man. Such a foundation cannot bear the gospel. Then the gospel is understood simply as a kind of general cheerfulness or a kind of optimistic attitude. And that isn't the gospel. That is some kind of humanism. So, the Oaths for Confession, of course, presupposes, as it itself says, the high and mighty articles of a great divine majesty. This is presupposed and taken for granted, and we cannot go behind that or substitute something else and then say we still have the gospel. Agreement in the gospel means agreement in everything that this implies and presupposes. Not in some half sheet of notepaper we agree that Jesus Christ died for us. But agreement in the Trinity, the two natures of Christ, the incarnation, the redemption, the threefold office of Christ, justification, sanctification, the means of grace, the church, eschatology, all this is included and is part of it. And the easiest way to realize that this is a true interpretation of the confessions is to think what was the attitude of the confessors at Augsburg to the sacrament. Did they regard the sacrament, for instance, as something where you could teach this way or that? Quite clearly, the Formula of Concord decided and quoted Luther in Article 7, paragraph, I think, 33, where he says, "I count them all into one cake, in einen Kuchen, in one Irish stew, who will not believe that Christ gives us his true body and blood." It's all enthusiasm. Whoever doesn't wish to confess that, don't let him expect any fellowship from me, but leave me entirely alone. This is final. This is the attitude of the Church of the Oaths for Confession. This is the ecumenical attitude to those who wish to compromise and take away some of the substance of the gospel of the one Christ. Now, it is often put this way, and I've seen it in rather standard works even, that those who follow, say, Dr. Walter's tradition, they take the Augsburg Confession in all sorts of other documents, and they're not happy with merely agreement in the Augsburg Confession. Whereas then there are the good Lutherans, who are quite happy if you merely sign the Augsburg Confession and the other confessions, and then this is supposed to be the genuine Lutheran approach. This is a frightfully shallow caricature, isn't it? The truth of the matter is that Dr. Walther, and this is on record, Dr. Walther was prepared to recognize as truly Lutheran anybody who seriously accepted nothing more than the Augsburg Confession. That said, Walther is quite sufficient. If anybody truly and genuinely accepts the Augsburg Confession, I accept him as a true Lutheran. But of course that means that he will also have to, when he becomes acquainted with them, agree with everything in the formula of Concord, because this is nothing but the statement of what is already implied and presupposed in the Augsburg Confession. So Walther definitely said that the Augsburg Confession is quite enough. Yet in another sense, not even the formula of Concord is enough. Because again, it isn't a matter of signing some official collection of words, but of agreeing in the substance. And that means that when people interpret the formula of Concord this way or that way, then even that may be inadequate, and we may have to go more deeply into the matter and decide, well, what really is the substance which the confession and the formula intend? The whole thing hinges upon the very concept of revealed dogma, revealed truth. This, of course, is very unpopular in a theology which, in place of Aristotle, has canonized Kant, which is a bad exchange, but at least we mustn't canonize either. But we must not confuse Jesus Christ with Pontius Pilate, but know that there is such a thing as revealed truth, doctrine, teaching. This may become doubtful in churches which have no confession. Just before I left Australia, a Methodist clergyman from a neighboring town was received into our conference by colloquy. And he said, the book that really brought him into our church was the Book of Concord. I never realized, he said, that such a book existed. We don't have anything like this. What a marvelous thing, a statement of clear confession of doctrine. That's what brought him to the ecumenical truth. This, the concept of dogma, of divinely revealed truth, may be in doubt in churches where this background isn't to be heard. But it should not be in doubt in a church which, whose latest human form was conceived in theses and born of a confession and weaned, as it were, if we may put it that way, on a formula. Because if anything is certain for us Lutherans, it is the concept of dogma and confession of divine truth. An interesting thing that somebody, I forgot who, has pointed out, maybe some others, that most of the polemics in the Book of Concord are directed against adherence of the Augsburg Confession. That's interesting. If you look at the history of the other confessions, the polemics in the formula of Concord, most of this is directed, practically all of it, is directed against false adherence, those who claim to adhere to the Augsburg Confession, but don't. So, dogma is restatable, confessable, and this is part of the presupposition of the Ecumenical Confession of Augsburg. I come to the final and perhaps to the most specific thing. And that is, what are we now to do about this Ecumenical Confession? Wouldn't it be a great thing if we could gather throughout the world churches which are committed to this confession, gather them into one strong movement, and bear witness jointly before the world to the one ecumenical truth of God? Well, for many people, the impression prevails that this is available in the Lutheran World Federation, that this opportunity exists there. The question, and this is a very acute question for your synod and for mine, is this really an opportunity to confess ecumenically with the confessors of God? And, by your leave, I should like to deal here with two kinds of issues. I'll keep it as short as I can, our time is running out. But I'd like to again call attention to the importance of dealing with realities rather than formalities and merely verbal tags. I should like to ask, first of all, the question of substance and of fact. In fact, aside from all theory and wishful thinking, what in fact does the LWF consist of? And secondly, what in fact is it in its nature? And what sort of relation these churches call themselves Lutheran, there is a grave problem attached to this, because when you analyze finally, what does it mean? In what sense are they adherents of the Oath of Confession? You finally come to this, that these churches, the state churches I mean now, are Lutheran largely in this sense that their predecessors 400 years ago were Lutheran. They have this historic succession. They stand in the place of those who once confessed at Augsburg. And in their constitutions they refer to, in various capacities, to the Augsburg Confession and to the others. But let me give you a concrete example of what kind of Lutheranism is involved, for instance, in Germany. You have there an interesting formation called the EKID, Evangelische Kirche in Deutschland, EKID, Evangelical Church in Germany. This consists of the Lutheran and the Reformed and the Union churches of Germany, the established churches there. The history is interesting. The Missouri Synod, of course, comes from the movement of rationalism and other Midwestern synods, from the Prussian Union, begun by King Frederick William III, particularly in 1817. The reactions of that, well, resulted in the immigration to Australia and to America. This Union Church, the Union of Lutheran and Reformed, against which some protested and were violently persecuted, that continued, and continued right up to the present time. But recently something much more dramatic has happened. Under Hitler, the idea occurred to the government, and especially to Hitler, that it would be very nice to unite the Protestant Church. It would be very handy to deal with one group. And so he hit upon the idea of one large imperial church, the Imperial Protestant Church. And he appointed even a certain Reichsbishop by the name of Miller, Reichsbishop, Imperial Bishop. But this didn't take very well, because these people pushed particularly so-called German Christianity, which meant these racial theories and Nazism and so on. And in reaction to the government harassment, there arose a so-called confessional church, a confessing church, with its Barmen Declaration of 1934. But these people acted together as Lutheran, Reformed, and Union, and began to think of themselves as the Evangelical Church. And when the thousand-year empire collapsed in 1945, then there was set up the Evangelical Church of Germany, consisting of all these Lutheran, Reformed, and Union churches. And it's interesting to note, you can find all this documented, most of this, in Church and Fellowship, a very useful volume, which gives detailed documents, published by it gives the various arrangements and agreements and decisions made within these various state churches. And it is said, quite frankly, that the EKID is a federation within which we hope that the New Testament reality of the Ecclesia exists, as will manifest itself. Some of the Lutherans claim there is only a federation and not a church. The Reformed insist that it is a church. It calls itself a church. If it isn't a church, it's really misnamed, because it calls itself the Evangelical Church of Germany. And the fact of the matter is that the Lutheran churches are in intercommunion with the Reformed churches in this union, this evangelical union. What for Luther was impossible, what Luther considered sacrilege, that at one and the same altar there should kneel one man who believes he's receiving the body of Christ, and another man who believes he's receiving bread and wine. Luther said sacrilege, that this, they too should receive it at the same altar. This is taken as self-evident and taken for granted within the Evangelical Church in Germany, where there is complete intercommunion, and where, as a matter of principle, all members may receive. If you move from one territorial church to another one, you automatically become a member of that territorial church. And the principle is recognized of open intercommunion. Schweizer especially even stated that. The Church of Sweden, for instance, is in formal communion with the Church of England and with the Church of Scotland, Presbyterian. And so is the Church of Finland and the Church of Denmark, and I don't know about the Church of Norway, but I assume that is the case too. That means, of course, that when these so-called Lutheran churches say that they confess the Confession of Augsburg and of the Formula of Concord, this means no more than some fond sentimental remembrance of some history. cultural differences in interpretation cannot divide us today. So, in a sense, as judged by the confessions of the 16th century, these churches have ceased to be Lutheran. And this is why Dr. Sasser, for instance, when this evangelical church took shape, resigned from the University of Erlangen and left and went into exile, as it were, into Australia. Now, this is only as regards the Lord's Supper. One could mention many other things. The foundations of all of Christianity, the Bultmannism and so on, the collapse of spiritual life entirely. When I was in Finland, in connection with the Helsinki Assembly, I went with some friends to inspect some local churches. And we saw one of the two main parish churches in the heart of Helsinki, in a parish of 20,000 people, and this church seated 3,000. And we asked the cleaning woman, how many attend here on Sunday? She said to my Finnish friend, I'm not supposed to tell the foreigners, but I'll tell you, 65. And in the summer, not even they come, and we have to close down completely. That's in a parish of 20,000 in the heart of Helsinki. Now, it's not quite as bad in some of the country areas. In some places, the percentage is quite good. In Bavaria, it is said to be as high as 10% of the population. But you see, I'm saying this in order that we may evaluate what it means when people talk of so many millions of Lutherans. A vast majority of these millions are purely statistical and exist nowhere but on paper. This is important in evaluating the reality of this particular organization. Now lastly, finally, when this kind of thing is pointed out, and not only the total collapse on the Lord's Supper, but the total collapse on even fundamental Christian beliefs, then it is often argued, yes, that is all very true, there are many things that are to be deplored, it's quite shocking, but of course it's only purely a federation, not a church, and therefore this is a good opportunity to bring to bear the witness of the pure gospel. And we're not compromising anything because it's only an association, a free association. Well, this of course we need to examine very carefully. On the face of it, what would you say to a person who said to you, you know, America isn't a nation, neither is Australia, because it's only a federation of states. We would suspect that there's something wrong in the argument, and of course there is. Because there's nothing incompatible in being a nation and being at the same time a federation of states. The two concepts move in sort of on different tracks. Parallelly, to say that something is a federation and therefore not a church is to commit the sin of irrelevance. I remember Dr. Franzman used to quip in his classes the famous false contradistinction, the tree is not thick but green. Why can't it be both? Why can't something be a federation and a church? The Missouri Synod, in its structure, is a federation of autonomous congregations. But is anybody going to say that therefore it isn't a church? Of course it's a church. So whether something that is a federation is also a church must be determined on some other basis than merely its form of organization. We Lutherans, according to Article 7, don't make organization the prerequisite. It's what the thing is and what it does that determines for us the nature of the thing. The LWF itself is not competent to tell us whether it is a church or not, because to say whether it is or not would presuppose a doctrine of the church. But the LWF doesn't really have any doctrine, and therefore doesn't have a doctrine of the church. It only has a doctrinal basis. And this doctrinal basis, some may build on it gold, some silver, some hay, and some straw. But the Federation as such has no doctrine, only a doctrinal basis. So wrote Bishop Lillian, response to an inquiry to the Free Church. But if it doesn't have as such a doctrine of the church, then of course it can't define whether it is a church or not, because this is presupposed. You have to first know what the church is. But people who do have a doctrine of the church should then see, well, what does this organization do? And I'm quite surprised when I hear that at Helsinki, for instance, the LWF made it clear that it is not a church. A great deal was said about it not being a super church. Yes, but nobody said it was a super church. That wasn't the point. point was, what makes a body a church is not some part of compulsion. This is a papacy. A church isn't a church because it can compel somebody. A church is a church in the Lutheran, biblical understanding, because it acts as the ecclesia. It acts as a church of Christ in jointly administering the word and sacrament, jointly bearing witness to the truth of Christ. This is church work. This is being the church. And this, the Elder Blair has made it very clear, precise at Helsinki, because the new amended constitution, for the first time now, actually says elders out in Article 3, Paragraph 1, where it says that the LWF carries out churchly functions. It says when it does this, it does not do this on its own authority, but on behalf of the member churches. Now, the church governmental question on whose authority it does it, that isn't of interest to us. The question is, does it carry out churchly functions? The answer is in the constitution, yes. And this is buttressed in various ways, and in the very reality of it. In the very fact that the Theological Commission, for instance, presupposed and stated in its official report that all the member churches ought to enter formal church fellowship with one another, because this is really involved and implied in their membership in the Federation. The most applauded essay at Helsinki was that by Professor Clifford Nelson, entitled The One Church and the Lutheran Church. He says, on page 7 of this applauded essay, that earlier at Copenhagen in 1929, Dr. Alfred Jørgensen, Danish member of the Executive Committee, addressed the Assembly on a worldwide Lutheran Church. He proposed, among other things, an international Lutheran theological faculty to help actualize a world church. And so on. The modern Lutheran Church, he said, insofar as its members are true to the confessions, is a unit. It is a church. No doubt the leaders of the Lutheran World Convention and the Lutheran World Federation felt that they were acting wisely in making disclaimers of intentions to being or becoming a church in a constitutional sense. But that organized world Lutheranism was an expression of the Ecclesia had already been recognized. Jørgensen, it is a church. Nevertheless, a prudential concern dictated then that faith be made slowly in order to dissipate anxieties and to avoid shattering by precipitous action what had already been achieved. In other words, church politics kept them from saying that it is a church. But really, it has the reality of the Ecclesia. This is the claim, this is the presupposition. Now, I can't continue this forever. I'd only like to refer you to two important articles in this connection. One by Peter Brunner in the December 1960 issue of the Lutheran World, the official publication of the Lutheran World Federation. And there Dr. Peter Brunner argues that the Lutheran World Federation is in fact a church, that it cannot even carry out a single assembly without teaching, without making doctrinal decisions, and thereby has to act willy-nilly as church. Because, says Peter Brunner, when it teaches, it is undoubtedly acting as a church, because teaching is a central function, the central commission that Christ has given to his church. And the last reference is an article in the Lutheran World of April 1964, where Professor Lehmann, one of the church law experts, along with Professor Brinkman, who at the Helsinki Assembly, by the way, advised that no official commentary on the Constitution be adopted because it was nonsense to have a commentary on the Constitution. The Constitution must be clear. This Professor Lehmann writes in a very penetrating, very interesting article, comes to the conclusion that the LWF is in fact a church in every sense. And he adds the interesting thing that it represents a type of church answering to the demands of the modern world and with a quite new character, but rich in promise for the future. He points out that in the trend now is against what he calls an imperial structure of the church, a church empire. But the 20th century trend is that of a loosely connected commonwealth of churches. And he says that Rome, which always had its ear to the ground, and which understood the trends of the times very clearly, has seen this tendency and is preparing itself by decentralization for this new ecumenical federated church, in which, of course, it plans to take leadership. So that the shape of the future church will be, apparently, a very loose federation, more or less autonomous unit, under a figurehead like the papacy, but in which doctrinally and liturgically, one will go this way and one man. Against this vision of this federation arising, it seems to me that those who still take seriously the doctrine of the Church as stated in the Augsburg Confession in Article 7 must find ways and means of confessing this in word and action, and of making this prevail, of testifying to this, not merely in word but in deeds which speak louder than words, and in finding in general a way to realize and confess Luther's great insight when he said, "The Holy Christian Church speaks thus, I believe one Holy Christian Church. The mad Church of the Pope says, I see one Holy Christian Church." It is a matter for us in this anniversary year of the Reformation to walk by faith and not by sight. Remembering that Christ didn't say where 2 or 3 million are gathered together, but that we are to find the sheep by finding first of all the shepherd. If we cling to the pure voice of the shepherd, then we shall also have the sheep, but not vice versa. This is a kind of confession, the kind of loyalty, the kind of ecumenicity, the kind of ecumenical magnetism which is demanded of those who today understand and confess the ecumenical confession at Oxford. Well, I better cease. I'm afraid I've imposed upon you already, but I'm quite willing to respond to any discussion that you may have. I'm glad you asked that, because I should have mentioned there are so many things I ought to have mentioned yet, but one of them was this. There's a tremendous movement called Kein anderes Evangelium, No Other Gospel, a movement which consisted largely of laymen and grassroots pastors, and quite a strong movement, I believe, of people who are shocked and terrified by the undermining of fundamental Christian belief that has been going on at the universities, and we wish to take some action and apply some testimony against that. Now, they have worried some of the church government considerably, and some have concluded and said, oh, it's just a very small fraction of a percentage, to which the reply was, yes, but this happens to be the fraction that still goes to church. So they have to take note of a movement which is of considerable magnitude. I'm hoping and praying that this will catch on more and more, and that they will see finally what they have to do in order to have a consistent witness. Ultimately, they will have to force these churches to decide one way or the other, because it's quite impossible, of course, in a modern state where, say, 90% of the people are post-Christian. It's impossible to expect that these 90% of practical pagans will continue to maintain the church or to have any care for the confession. So of course these 10% will have to be used to the fact that if they wish pure confession, they can't expect this within the structure of a kind of police subdivision of the state. So in Sweden, for instance, you join the Church of Sweden, not by baptism, but by being born in Sweden or in a Swedish vessel. So that by virtue of Swedish nationality, there are even communists sitting on church councils, because there are Swedes and are such members of the national church. And when Bishop Boyeux and others of the more conservative movement resisted this, proposed to resist the ordination of women, of priestesses, the Solicitor General threatened to prosecute them because they were violating a decree of the Parliament. It's a law to have these priestesses, and how can you violate the law? So those who take seriously the confession will finally have to see that they cannot depend upon a basically pagan state, a post-Christian state, to ensure Christian standards. They will have to, if they wish to be confessionally independent, they will have to finally step outside the system. And then they'll be free to confess. are very polite compared to some other things that have been said. I think it's the only thing that they could say in the circumstances. And it seems to me particularly odd that at a time when Roman Catholics like Pym are seeing some of the justification of Luther, then some Lutherans should be deviating and compromising the sola and thinking of, well, we have to correct it somehow more with the Roman idea. Now, I can't believe that the three solas do literally safeguard the solus Christus, and if you attack any of the solas, you're really attacking the solus Christus. And this is essential to the ecumenical gospel. I may have quite misunderstood your point. That's an excellent point. But I would like to enlarge upon it like this. I was trying to judge the Augsburg on its own terms and Trent on its terms. And it seems to me that if you judge Augsburg by its own terms, on its own terms, on the objective, what is theologically objective, the biblical point of view, this is truly ecumenical. But Rome and Trent pretend to be ecumenical in another sense, don't they? And the Roman idea of ecumenicity includes this vast representation from everywhere. And this, on its own terms, is what Trent didn't have. He had the papacy, of course, but it was in a very, very unconvincing sense any sort of ecumenical council. So I was really trying to point out that on its own terms, on Roman terms, Trent was pretty unecumenical, un-Catholic, although on its terms, Augsburg lever a bit and oblige us to say. I met in Germany about 4 years ago when I went to Helsinki some very interesting state church people. One of them was a pastor in Hamburg. He wasn't a pastor, but he had theological training, and he told me that because of he knew that Bachmann, after being ordained in the state church of Hamburg, he couldn't with a pure conscience accept to call there. So he went into social work. And he said to me that the Bishop of Hamburg is very conservative. He's not a Bachmannite. And he smoked out with Bachmannism in the case of one young fellow who didn't quite come clear with it. But the next week he ordained him. And I asked him if he hadn't. Well, as a bishop he has to, because he has to perform this particular function to accredit the state-supplied clergy. And because this particular man couldn't in conscience accept as brothers in office people who rejected the fundamentals of the Christian faith, therefore he went into social work. He says, there are others like me too. And a particular example that he gave, the example of the so-called Kapellen in Hamburg. Now, in the last century, in the confessional revival, a number of congregations were formed, the so-called Kapellen, the chapels there, which had quite a salutary influence and resisted the decay in the general church structure. Baptist people thought they could witness from within and ultimately reform the structure. Today, said that man, today they're on the same level as all the others. They've lost what they once had. He said, learn that lesson. It's impossible to do it from within. He said, don't do what they did. That's what that man said, and others like that too. I think within the state church structure, with a modern state becoming more and more secular, impossible to conduct any kind of confessional church. And I just had before me Dr. Franzmann's excellent statement in this essay on the Lutheran Confession, where he says, many forms of organizational manifestation in the New Testament, but is there any evidence that there was anything like an organizational recognition of fractional obedience to the one Lord? And it seems to me that the elderly is that. It's an organizational recognition of fractional obedience to the one Lord. And this is from the New Testament point of view, impossible. After all, fellowship is not a formal declaration of somebody wearing altar and pulpit fellowship, but it is acting together on the assumption that we're brothers in the faith. And jointly testify, this is acting together as church. And we're only destroying with words, with deeds, what we're trying to accomplish with words if we do that, to my mind.